We have been looking at Leviticus last week with the duties of the priest, fitting the book into its place after Exodus, before we get to Numbers and we get back into more of the historical part of the journey of the children of Israel as they left Egypt. And this morning we're going to primarily talk about Nadab and Abihu, which probably amongst the stories in the Old Testament we know as well as we know any other story because of the action that was taken by God because he was upset with how they performed their duties. Last week we looked at the consecration of the priest, Aaron and his sons. Now, there were four of them, you remember? We got Nadab and Abihu that we're going to talk about for the most part this morning, and then Eleazar and Ithamar, who we really don't know a lot about other than they were the two remaining sons after Nadab and Abihu were struck dead. So keeping in mind we've got Aaron and we've got his four sons who were the objects who were the subjects, rather, that were being consecrated in chapter 8 that we looked at primarily last week. Go back with me to chapter 8, verse 15 and 16, as we look at this consecration. There's a couple of things I want you just to have stuck in the back of your mind. Find some place that you don't have occupied with something else and just put this little bit of information there. We'll use it later. You won't have to store it for a long period of time. We'll just stick it there. We'll come back and we'll get it within the next 40 minutes. So it shouldn't trouble us too much. Chapter 8, verse 15. Leviticus chapter 8, verse 15. And Moses killed it, talking about the sacrifice. Then he took the blood and he put some on the horns of the altar all around with his finger and he purified the altar. And he poured the blood at the base of the altar and he consecrated it to make atonement for it. Then he took all the fat that was on the entrails, the fatty lobe attached to the liver and the two kidneys with their fat, and Moses burned them on the altar. What I want you to stick in the back of your mind is that the fact that Moses prepared and offered a sacrifice with fire at the start of the consecration period of Aaron and his sons. That's all you have to remember. There was fire. Moses did it. There's no evidence here as to where the fire came from. It's just simply that Moses burned it. There could be a number of explanations. Don't know. Just fact. What's the fact? The fact is that Moses started a fire, burned a sacrifice to God. Okay? Hold on to that. Go to chapter 9, verse 23 and 24. Do you remember we talked about last week that Aaron and his sons, after these offerings and after these anointments, spent 7 days in the tabernacle? Then on the 8th day, were presented back to the people. There was another sacrifice required at the end of those 8 days. That was just the tail end of what we talked about last week. We didn't get very far into it, but as that process took place of 7 days separated and then the 8th day presented back to the Israelites, another sacrifice took place. Chapter 9, verse 23 and 24. And Moses and Aaron went into the tabernacle of meeting. They came out and they blessed the people. Then the glory of the Lord appeared to all the people. And fire came out from the Lord and consumed the burnt offering and the fat on the altar. When all the people saw it, they shouted and fell on their face. Okay, where'd the fire come from? Here, in this particular case, God. So previously, Moses, at the start of this process, had made a sacrifice. That fire came from somewhere. We don't know from whence it came. It could have been two sticks rubbed together. It could have been God presenting it. We don't know. Here, in chapter 9, at the end of that period of consecration, there is fire that comes down from heaven. It's a visual signal to the Israelites. It's there. God's going to put some fire on this thing. God's going to put His stamp of approval on this act of consecrating these priests. Okay? Again, just hold on to that. I'm not going to try to tie it in necessarily right this second. Just remember, there was fire, came from somewhere, we don't know. Then there was fire that we do know came from God. Okay? Hold on to it. Chapter 10, Nadab and Abihu. It's a great story. It's one of those stories that's got lessons put on top of lessons put on top of lessons. It's all there for us. It's just, and it's so simple, and it's not very long when it comes down to the actual events themselves. It's what happened after the events that makes the difference. You know, how many times have you said to someone, a friend, in my case, what I'm remembering primarily is my children, son or daughter, it's not what you did that defines you, it's how you respond to what you did. I mean, have we said that? Have we looked at those that we love and made that comment? We all make mistakes. What matters is how you respond to that mistake. Nadab and Abihu made a big mistake. Nadab and Abihu made such a mistake that they themselves didn't have a chance to respond to it. But the Israelites in total, did. Moses did. Aaron and his two remaining sons did. So chapter 10, verse 1. Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, each took his censer and put fire in it, put incense in it, and offered profane fire before the Lord, which He had not commanded them. Some of your versions may say strange fire. Do I have anything other than either strange or profane?
Unauthorized.
Unauthorized. What version are you reading from, Jerry?
ESV.
Okay. The word, yes?
Unlawful.
Unlawful. All right, so we've got profane, unauthorized, unlawful, strange. The word actually there, the Hebrew word, is the word for, or meaning, to, not the word for, but the meaning of the word literally is to commit adultery. Does that bring it into focus a little bit for what exactly it was that they did? What was the penalty for adultery? Turn to Leviticus chapter 20, verse 10. Leviticus chapter 20, verse 10. The man who commits adultery with another man's wife, he who commits adultery with his neighbor's wife, the adulterer and the adulteress shall surely be put to death. Is that pretty clear? What happened to Nadab and Abihu? In a sense of the term, did they commit adultery before God? And because they did, because this fire was strange or profane. We don't really know. Do we know what the fire was? What facts do we have? We have one fact, and we have two educated guesses. And I don't really have a problem with either one of the two educated guesses because they're pretty clear as to what happened in the event that we get explained to us afterwards. But as far as facts go, we have one. And that is the last part of the first verse, which it said, which He had not commanded them. Okay? That's it. Now, how many times do we make an argument, and when I say we, I'm not necessarily meaning all of us here in this room this morning. We as in mankind, we as in the 21st century Christians used in air quotes. How many times do we make an excuse to justify something we've done by saying, well, God didn't say not to? This should clarify that without any doubt whatsoever. God did not tell them what not to do, but He certainly gave them a very specific instruction as to what to do with this fire. I don't know what it is. It doesn't really matter. It's kind of the same thing as Cain and Abel. We don't have anything identified as to what the commands were regarding the sacrifices. We just know that one of the two was not acceptable before God. And this makes it very clear here when it comes to Nadab and Abihu that they had been told what to do. They had not been told what not to do. And then they paid for it with their life. Chapter 6, verse 12. Let's get back to things that we know for a fact. I probably should have read this one a while ago. I let it slip up on me. Regarding the fire on the altar, we know, according to chapter 6, verse 12 and 13, and the fire on the altar shall be kept burning on it. It shall not be put out. And the priest shall burn wood on it every morning and lay the burnt offering in order on it. And he shall burn on it the fat of the peace offerings. A fire shall always be burning on the altar. It shall never go out. Okay? That's what we know. Does that go back to day one of the consecration process when Moses put the fire on the altar? Probably. Again, though, do we know where that fire came from on that and that event? For that matter, had they done sacrifices before we actually get to this part with the tabernacle? What series of events took place after Moses came down off the mountain? First of all, what instructions did Moses get on the mountain? Among other things. What about the tabernacle? Yes, somebody nod with me. Y'all are, dare I use the term dead this morning? Show me some life. Your team is not 1 in 3. Mine is. Now show me some life. Okay? When Moses came off the mountain regarding the tabernacle, what did we know? Did we have a tabernacle when Moses came off the mountain? All right. What did we use in place of this until such time as the tabernacle was built? Do you remember? We studied it. I threw it out there to you. Did you get it? Moses moved his tent outside the camp, and God came there, and it became a temporary tabernacle until such time as this could get built. Were there sacrifices? Were there things given before God? Yeah. Okay. Was it this altar that was inside the tabernacle? No. What is this instruction for? Regarding the tabernacle, okay? But there's sacrifices, there's fire, all these things are in their daily activities. Now we get to this point where we physically have a tabernacle. There's supposed to be fire on the altar. It's all set up exactly according to the dimensions that God gave. That fire was to be put on that altar and it was to never go out. It was to be continual. Now, if Moses lit the first match that started the first one and they kept it burning, what did God do in that scripture that we looked at just a few minutes ago at the end of chapter 9 regarding that fire? If it was smoldering, it wasn't smoldering anymore when God put that fire down on it. When He presented to the children of Israelites His blessing upon Aaron and his sons and their consecration. All right? What else do we know about how Nadab and Abihu... Well, I almost said that too far. I remember when I said we had one fact and we had two educated guesses? Let's get to one of those two educated guesses. Turn with me to chapter 16, verse 12. Now, I also, we had a warning last week that Leviticus itself was not necessarily sequential, chronological. It was a lot of the fill-in data that was given to us to bridge us from Exodus to Numbers. And to illustrate that point, we've got chapter 8 where we start talking about the priestly duties, which comes after the explanation, just a list of requirements for the sacrifices themselves. Jump ahead to chapter 16, and we've got some things that have to do with Moses and Aaron and how they dealt with Nadab and Abihu's sin. Okay, that's what we're looking at in chapter 16. Chapter 16, verse 12. Let's go back to 11 regarding God's instructions to Aaron in making atonement for this sin. And Aaron shall bring the bull of the sin offering, which is for himself, and make atonement for himself and for his house, and he shall kill the bull as the sin offering, which is for himself. Then he shall take a censer full of burning coals from the fire from the altar before the Lord, with his hands full of sweet incense beaten fine, and bring it inside the veil. He shall put the incense on the fire before the Lord, that the cloud of incense may cover the mercy seat that is on the testimony, lest he die. Now, I cannot tell you. I'll just admit to my own shortcomings, I guess. Any of us who have been Christians for any length of time are not surprised when we pick up on something in Scripture that we didn't realize was there before. It's the majesty of God's Word. And we look at something and we say, how have I missed that? It's been right here staring me in the face. Until I started prepping this series, I had missed the fact that we had this instruction in chapter 16 regarding exactly how that fire was to go inside the veil to the Holy of Holies. I blew it. But that's what this is talking about, the procedure for which that incense was to be offered. What was supposed to happen? Chapter 16, verse 12. Moses had a censer, right? You know what I'm talking about with a censer? A little pot, a little covered thing. And in that censer, he was to put coals, and those coals were to come from where? Okay. Where was the incense at this particular point in time? Not in the censer, in his hand. And then what was he supposed to do with those two items? Go inside. And there before God, he took the incense and he put it in the fire at that point in time. This is one of those educated guess things. Could this be part of the problem with Nadab and Abihu's? We don't know. Let me emphasize that again for everybody who's here and the whole world watching via the World Wide Web Internet that Al Gore invented, which we use effectively here. I don't know that that's what this was talking about with Nadab and Abihu. Am I clear on that? But what's an educated guess with this? Could that have been one of the things that was wrong with what Nadab and Abihu did? It could have been. Because there was a procedure. This is the way it was supposed to be done. Now, does that fit necessarily with profane fire or that which he had not commanded? And it does. Again, don't know that that's exactly what it was. But the situation fits. Can you start to see why God took some of this so seriously? On the surface, does it seem like a big deal? Fire is fire. If you go to cook something on the grill, does it matter where the fire came from? But when you go to sacrifice before God, does it matter where the fire came from? Very simply, we don't know. We also do know that after this, God gave Aaron a couple of other instructions. Chapter 10, verse 8. Then the Lord spoke to Aaron, saying, "Do not drink wine or intoxicating drink, you nor your sons with you, when you go into the tabernacle of the meeting, lest you die. It shall create a statute forever throughout your generations, that you may distinguish between holy and unholy, between clean and unclean." I think we need to remember something here. This is immediately after this incident. We do not know that alcohol was involved in the sin of Nadab and Abihu. But how many times, as a parent, have you not thought about making a rule that says, don't do something to your kids because you've explained what you want done and that should take care of it? And then later, because of the activity that took place, had to go back and revise the rule or clarify the rule. This looks very similar to that very thing. Nadab and Abihu went in. They sinned. There was something wrong with the fire. Down in verse 8, immediately after this event has taken place, God clarifies. Hey, by the way, there needs to be this alcohol rule. Now, he didn't say because Nadab and Abihu went in there and they were drunk, or because Nadab and Abihu went in there and they had been drinking, but he makes it clear that there is not, that activity is not to take place. And he doesn't say drinking to the point of being drunk. He says drinking. "And you will drink neither wine nor intoxicating drink, so that you," why? "Can distinguish between that which is holy and unholy." Are we kind of getting the drift here as to what God expected? Why did He need to make that rule after this event? Maybe it had something to do with the event to begin with. Again, am I disclaiming this enough? I can't say that for a fact. But those two educated guesses regarding how the incense was to be burned, and secondly regarding the actions of Nadab and Abihu, are glaring me right in the face when it comes to how they went about doing their thing. You know, we have in the 21st century an idea in our mind of what intoxicated is and where does it come from. Comes from whatever the legal definition is, probably, does it not? When you say, when the question is, well, are they intoxicated? Legally, I can't remember, what is it, 0.08? I don't even know. I know it's less than it used to be. I know that it used to be 0.1. I think it's come down for whatever driving under the influence or driving while intoxicated is. As over time, our medicine has increased, the quality of our medicine has increased, and we've been able to determine certain things about how much it takes to impair us, to make our judgment slow, etc., and so on. What happens with even one small drink, not forgetting the 0.8 or 0.10 or whatever the number is? Does something start to happen with our senses? Okay? It's not one of those magic things that you drink up to X and then suddenly all this kicks in. The effect of the alcohol has an impact at first, regardless of whether you're legally intoxicated. Am I railing against drinking this morning? That's not the point of the lesson. The point of the lesson is that priests were forbidden to do anything that would put them in a position not to make sound judgment. That's the point. And God felt it was necessary to illustrate or to give that rule by telling them, you will not drink wine or intoxicating drink, period, before you go in. Now, do we see that in certain jobs today in our environment? Airline pilots is one that comes to mind. They cannot have a drink of any type of alcoholic beverage within X hours before they go fly. To be realistic or to be honest, if the pilot steps off the plane and he goes into the lounge and he has a sip of some type of alcoholic beverage, is he going to be impaired to his ability to fly the plane? And the answer is probably not. Now, we get into that thing of judgment as to, okay, at what point does he become? And that's why you have the rule. The FAA says no. 8 hours before he flies, there is nothing of alcoholic nature that can go in him. What's God saying to the priest? Hey, when you get ready to go into my holy place, you better not have been conducting your daily life with, including this activity, you better not have been drinking. Isn't that pretty simple? Pardon? And Tommy points out, he says you will die. And Nadab and Abihu proved that you will die. We don't know, again, but two pretty good educated guesses. Let's get back to the event itself. Bill? We read it a few minutes ago.
Did you?
Mm-hmm. About the order in which we put the coals in the censer?
No.
Leviticus 16, 1 and 2?
1 and 2.
Isn't that what I read a while ago?
No.
What did I read? Oh, I read 16, 12. 16, 1 and 2. Get it? Now let's go back and read 16, 1 and 2. Not 12. Now the Lord spoke to Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron when they offered the profane fire before the Lord. And the Lord said to Moses, tell Aaron your brother not to come at just any time into the holy place inside the veil before the mercy seat which is on the ark, lest he die, for I will appear in the cloud above the mercy seat. All right, Bill's point's going to be that there was also there could have been a timing issue. It was during a period of time where they were not authorized to come in. So, no, I wasn't, because I didn't have that in my notes. What that does to us is give us three educated guesses, not just two. Okay? So there's a timing issue. There's the issue of possibly drinking. There's the issue of how they went about putting the incense into the censer itself.
And where they got the fire.
Well, that's what I mean by the censer. The whole censer incident, yes. The fact that the instruction was to take the coals out of. All right. Chuck, do you have your hand up?
One more guess.
Go.
Six.
So they're not properly dressed? Could have been. Well, and that would fit good too with, have been drinking. They forgot to put on the tunics. Morris? To summarize Morris's point, it's not just the limit at which you become legally drunk. It's what you're doing because you're impaired, and his point was you're not allowed to operate a motor vehicle while you're under the influence. And I guess if we want to continue to carry that too, isn't there probably an open container law? Well, what's the point of that? The point of it is that you're not allowed to be drinking while you're driving, whether you're drunk or not. And so Nadab and Abihu weren't allowed to participate in that kind of activity when they got ready to go before God, because what was the place? Give me one word that describes the place that they went into that got in this state and got them in trouble.
Holy.
Holy. Okay? All right, now let's go back up to verse 3. What would you do if your sons had just been struck dead in the performance of their duties as you thought they were going about to go before God? How would you feel? How do you think Aaron felt? What's the first thing that we see after we get the incident itself? Moses interacting with Aaron. Look at verse 3. And Moses said to Aaron, this is what the Lord spoke, saying, by those who come near me, I must be regarded as holy. And before all the people, I must be glorified. What's the next five words? Five words.
Aaron held his peace.
So Aaron held his peace. Whoa. That's a pretty powerful sermon right there. So Aaron held his peace. What would you want to say if your children had just been killed by God?
You'd rail against God. Emotionally.
Emotionally, you'd be a wreck. Tasha said you would rail against God. Do you think Aaron wanted to? I don't know. But what did Moses do to make sure it didn't happen? He said, Aaron, stop. What's holy is holy. You can't desecrate that. So Aaron held his peace. There was a bigger picture here. The Israelites needed to see what had happened and understand and what the sentence, the consequence of Nadab and Abihu's action was. In order to see that consequence, then everyone had to continue to do their job. And if the chief high priest, Aaron, had gone on a rant against God, what would that have told the children of Israel? Aaron had to support the company. He had to do what he did because God was more important than even Aaron's sons. Oh, wait. Is there a lesson for us there? Who's first in our life? Before our wife, before our children, before our parents, and on and on and on. Who is it? God is. We get this lesson right here. Old Testament, just shortly after we've left Egypt, we absolutely do. Real quickly, verse 4, Moses called for Nadab and Abihu's body to be carried out. So they went near and carried them, this is verse 5, by their tunics out of the camp as Moses had said. And Moses said to Aaron and Eleazar and Ithamar, do not uncover your heads nor tear your clothes, lest you die and wrath come upon all the people. But let your brethren, the entire house of Israel, bewail the burning which the Lord has kindled. You shall not go out from the door of the tabernacle, lest you die. For the anointing oil of the Lord is on you. And they did according to the word of Moses. It's a pretty serious event. It took place in such a public fashion. But it taught a tremendous lesson to all the Israelites, and it's got one that's a pretty good lesson for us as well. And then we jump, and if we skip everything that's kind of in between here in chapter 16, we get back to the actual events that took place in order to clean this mess up. And how Aaron was to atone for this, and so on and so forth, to the people. So, think about the things that have happened. We took Aaron and his sons, four of them. We anointed them with oil and blood. We offered sacrifices. We kept them in seclusion for 7 days. On the eighth day they came out. We presented them before God. There was fire from heaven. Shortly thereafter, Nadab and Abihu took this action. There was more fire from heaven. And now we've got two less priests. And this is all happening fairly quickly. Were there some powerful, powerful lessons here? And there absolutely were. A lot of lessons for us. When God says do it this way, it does not give us the right to say otherwise. And certainly God's more important than everyone, including our family. Yes, Granny.
We can't really know God if we don't study the Old Testament.
My mother-in-law's point is that we cannot know God unless we study the Old Testament. I agree with that. Salvation is presented to us as a plan in the New Testament. But as mature Christians, once we get past that point where we're babes, the study that we need to take place to look at these Old Testament stories, to draw the principles that we live under the New Testament, is imperative, I believe. I think you're right. Bill? Right.
So they weren't completely consumed.
There was something taken out. There were bones, ashes, a burned up glob of something that was taken out. It was a strange incident, wasn't it? Staying in chapter 10 and going to verse 16, I just want to point this out real quick. In all this hubbub, Moses chastised Aaron for not partaking of the food that had to do with the sin offering. And Aaron says, on such a day of my calamity, you expect me to remember all this, basically. And I was a fearful for what I might do, that I might do something else wrong. That's paraphrased. That's verses 16 through 20. But what does it say at the end of the chapter? So Moses heard that and was content. It's not as though Moses didn't have compassion on Aaron for his loss. And Moses did overlook this violation of the law regarding the sin offering and not eating of the food because of the calamity that had come to Aaron. We'll get into next week the sacrifices themselves, the burnt offering, the sin offering, wave offerings, heave offerings, all these different kind of things. I'm trying to find a good, easy chart. I want to give you something. I don't want you to memorize the offerings, but I can't keep them straight in my head. So sometimes it's good to have a cheat sheet to look at. One more thing real quick, chapter 21. I hope we got time. I threw this in there hoping we had time just to go there real quick. Chapter 21 has to do with some more regulations for the priests. Look in verses 18 through 20. Job description. I want you to look at this and pay attention to how politically incorrect this would be in the 21st century, in 2015. These are people who cannot be priests. Okay? Cannot be priests. For any man who has a defect shall not approach. A man blind or lame, who has a marred face. Do any of your versions say who has a flat nose? There's a version, I can't remember which one it is.
It's the Old King James.
It's the Old King James says, here instead of marred face, it says flat nose. Ha! I guess if some guy was a boxer and had his nose beat up, he couldn't be a priest. Are any limb too long for a man who has a broken foot or a broken hand, or is a hunchback or a dwarf, or a man who has a defect in his eye, or scratching, or a scab, or is a eunuch? We can't do this, can we? We cannot keep these people from doing a job. Well, guess what? We can. God had a reason. Those which came before Him in that holy place were to have certain qualifications, and these didn't fit them. In our more enlightened society, this feels just so ugly and rude to say something like this. But God made it clear. When it comes to coming before Him with those sacrifices and those other things in that holy place, there were regulations, restrictions, requirements, prerequisites, and not just anybody could do the job. Was there a place for people who had a broken hand, a broken foot, a leg too short, a leg too long, eczema? Was there a place for them? Yes. Was it serving God in the term of high priest going inside the Holy of Holies? No. Were these people scarred emotionally because of this? I don't know. But I kind of doubt it. Because there were jobs for everyone to do. And not everyone can be a high priest. Not everyone can be an elder in the church. There are some requirements. And that's what he's getting at here. The bell has rung. You need to go find your original or your favorite pews. So, questions or comments quickly? All right. Next week we'll look at the feast, or the sacrifices, rather.